Coming up on Tech News Weekly, bounty hunters can pay for easy access to your, yes, you, your real-time location data. The CNET roundup of everything at the Consumer Electronics Show. Also, replacing real meat with impossible meat, version 2.0. And how a meme becomes a meta meme. All that and more on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 65, recorded Thursday, January 10th, 2019. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by FreshBooks, the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software helping small business owners thrive. Try it free for 30 days at freshbooks.com/TNW.
Welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is a show where we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. Let's talk.
Yeah, let's get right to it. According to an investigation from Motherboard this week, T-Mobile, AT&T, and Sprint are selling our real-time location data, and it's ending up in the hands of bounty hunters who can easily geolocate our phones and therefore us.
Us.
Journalist Joseph Cox knows this to be true because he paid a bounty hunter to do it. Welcome to the show, Joseph.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So let's start with the basics first. What kind of location information do our cell phone providers have, and why do they have it?
So the way your phone works, it's constantly ringing out to cell phone towers by it. This is just how phones work. They need that to route text messages, route phone calls, and in virtue of that, it does give an approximate location. In our case, it was something like 500 meters, the radius of the circle. The telcos obviously take that data, but what they then do is actually store it and sell it to third parties. And that eventually trickles down to, as you said, these bounty hunters and me. And I clearly shouldn't be able to buy this data.
Okay, bounty hunters, right off the bat, like my ears perk up and I'm like, wow, like, it sounds really tough. What does a bounty hunter need for this location, and how are they being hired? What are they being hired for?
Right. It's not law enforcement, and that's why it jumps out, right? We've had a similar issue last year when the New York Times and Ron Wyden found a similar company, but that was to like low-level cops or prison staff without a warrant. This is private businesses and bounty hunters. They will use it to track down fugitives, find people who have skipped their bail. And I mean, they will, of course, argue that that is a legitimate purpose. But other people are going to disagree because there isn't consent necessarily being done there. When the telcos sell this data and the middleman companies, they say the target, for lack of a better word, must consent. That's not what's happening here. When we sent the location request and we geolocated someone's phone in Queens, New York, to a specific area, there was no warning on the phone. There was no text message. There was no, hey, do you consent to this? So even though there may be legitimate purposes, and there are some other ones as well, there's wide room for abuse here.
So is anyone actually breaking the law here, or is it all just in those pages and pages of things we agree to without reading? We are sort of giving our consent.
Yeah, that's the thing. I mean, you would feel that selling the location data of 100 millions of Americans, which is some of the most sensitive data possible, would not be legally above board. But of course, the US doesn't have great data protection legislation, if at all. There may be some breach of laws in repurposing the data, and I suppose it depends then what you go do with it. But the actual selling and trading of it is not an issue in the United States.
I feel like right now there's so many, we're hearing so much about, you know, privacy, obviously. Location data is a big topic that we've seen recurring through last year. A lot of the times it seems to involve that company called Facebook that we've may or may not have heard of before. This story, I mean, a lot of what's going on right here is in many ways just as, you know, kind of icky to a certain degree as a lot of the stuff that we're hearing from Facebook. Yet I feel like to a certain degree, a story like this isn't going to have the legs as if it had Facebook in the title. Why is that? What does that say about the public, about the media's kind of attention to actual privacy issues right now?
Yeah, when we think of privacy issues, you're right. We think of Facebook or maybe Google, and then maybe a few other companies as well. And these are, of course, the Silicon Valley tech companies, maybe Uber as well, when they had that data breach recently. And there is a cultural shift. I think maybe that's too grandiose a term, but people do care about privacy. The Cambridge Analytica story, people really, really followed that. But when it comes to the telcos, these are, even though everybody has a mobile phone, these are obscure companies to most people. People don't really know how phones work, like in the technical sense. They don't really know what happens to that data. So maybe it will have legs, and I agree with you, this will probably peter down as well. But we've been kept in the dark, not only as consumers, but policymakers as well, who are learning about this now. We've never really known what the telcos do with this data in any sort of detail. I mean, I think that's been like sort of the lack of movement in this area for at least some time, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's infuriating to me, because with Facebook or Google, you can at least say like, oh, well, we're getting a free service. But I mean, I get an enormous bill for internet service and cell phone service every month. And on top of that, they're selling my location. It seems very wrong.
Right. Yes. Like, of course, a T-Mobile bill, just for sake of example, would be $70, $75. Of course, you pay that. And then the telco is making more money by selling your data onto, obviously, these location aggregators, as they call them. I don't know how much money they actually make from that. As in, is it a side business or a primary part of the business or whatever it may be? But one source who's followed the industry for a while said, well, as long as there's money to make, they're still going to be selling the data. And of course, the telcos have said they are going to stop, but they haven't done that yet, clearly, because we bought this data in a few weeks into December.
Now, Microbuilt, you talk a little bit about Microbuilt in your article. They actually removed some pretty relevant documents from their site while you were working on the story. What was removed? What does that say? Like, how does that change things, if at all?
Yeah, so when I first reached out to Microbuilt, and this is the company that it comes after the telcos, after location aggregators, and then you have Microbuilt underneath that then sells to the bounty hunter companies in this really complex supply chain. When I first approached them for comment, they just said, please give us that phone number so we can look into it. We're not interested in an individual case of abuse or helping them police their own network. We're interested in exploring this systemic problem. So obviously we declined to provide the phone number. As for the documents, the one I found them removing in particular was a brochure that laid out their mobile device verify product. And this was like pretty interesting, saying explicitly what it's for chasing people who have skipped bail or whatever, and saying just sort of like technical details of how it actually works and that sort of thing. And I didn't think it was that particularly sensitive, because if you're tracking mobile phones, it's quite clear how it's going to work, but they felt compelled to remove it anyway.
So they're they're selling all of this data, maybe like legitimately. I mean, it seems illegitimately, but what about, how secure are they keeping it? Like, what about people that might just find this? Is this information on the deep web, or is it easy to access a person's location just from their phone number by not even having to buy this?
So as for the buying bit, first of all, I should clarify is like, it's mostly traded through, like word of mouth networks. I only bought it because I had a source who then had access in this sort of network of bounty hunters. As for whether they're secure or not, I don't have any specific information on Microbuilt being secure or unsecure, but another company, the one that the New York Times covered last year, along with Ron Wyden, called Securus, they were the ones giving location data to law enforcement without a warrant. A few days, maybe a week after that, a hacker actually contacted me, and they'd hacked Securus and they'd stolen thousands of login details. So maybe they could be representative of the industry. There was another company as well that was exposing the live data they were collecting on all the phones, and you could just go to their website and look up the location of any phone if you just knew how to interact with the website in a particular way. So there's at least two companies in this space which have seriously mishandled data. So I would not be surprised if others in the space aren't so serious about it either.
And then you're right, you know, as far as at least here in the U.S., three major networks, Verizon is seemingly absent from the list. Is this just because Verizon chooses not to sell this data, or is Verizon doing something else differently from the other three carriers that would kind of prevent these kind of middlemen from having access or providing access?
Yeah, so Verizon's been difficult. In the New York Times Securus story, I believe they were involved. The first time we covered a bounty hunter company, which actually shut down, I think, in 2014, 2015, Verizon was selling to them as well. Verizon aren't responding to my emails, so, you know, that'd be great if you want to actually have a call about it. But from what I understand, they dealt with similar issues last year. And I'm not exactly sure how they mitigated it or dealt with it, but it seems they have done something potentially more than the other carriers. The short answer is we don't exactly know Verizon's involvement, but it's not like they're going to be totally exempt from selling this data. I'm sure they sell it to the more legitimate ones, such as roadside assistance, when you have to find a stranded driver or emergency response and that sort of thing, because there's going to be a lot of phones on the Verizon network that need that capability as well. Mm-hmm. I'm just not sure if they do the bounty hunter stuff.
Sure.
So what has been the response to your piece so far? I know Wyden has been involved. Tell us a little bit about what's happened since you posted this.
Yeah, so Wyden is proposing a privacy bill that would do this sort of thing. And of course, it's not my place to have to say that would be a good or a bad thing. But that's, of course, the reason that he's interested in the story. There was also Senator Mark Warner, Harris as well. So several senators are calling for that. And also the commissioner to the FCC is saying that the FCC needs to investigate. With the government shutdown, it's not clear when that's actually going to happen. But maybe when it reopens, maybe there'll be an FCC investigation at some point. But again, this isn't the first time this sort of issue has come up with the telcos selling the data. But we'll see if it actually results in any sort of movement on their side or in the location aggregator side or in legislation. Because this is it's a legislation issue. It's not really a technical issue. The telcos, they need to be told, if this is what legislation wants to do, to not sell that data in the first place, or to severely restrict it. It's not really a technical issue. It's a legal one.
And I mean, there's so much money behind data, obviously, that, you know, these companies are making gobs and gobs of money from selling data. So to tell the telcos, you know, to basically eliminate that kind of flow of cash to their bottom line, that would be pretty significant, I have to imagine. And I just want to point out, just real quick, it's not a question or anything. I just want to say that I really appreciated there was Thomas Ridd, the professor at Johns Hopkins University, mm-hmm. made the comparison to Blade Runner, which is absolutely appropriate when you consider the subject matter of this news. So
aside from taking our iPhones and putting them in the microwave and, you know, for 10 minutes and getting rid of phones,
I do that every morning.
What is there anything we can do? Yeah. I'm not hardcore enough to not have a cell phone. Is there anything consumers mm-hmm. can do to stay more private?
It's hard. Because this isn't like delete your Facebook account, which is already difficult enough when everybody's friends and family is on Facebook anyway. This is even a harder problem because realistically, not many people can live without a phone, right? So, I mean, technically, you could put it on airplane mode, I guess, which should block the communications. You could perhaps not take your phone where you go to somewhere that you worry about, maybe a psychiatrist or an abortion clinic or whatever it may be. And I suppose it is also worth bearing in mind that even though the data of T-Mobile, AT&T, Sprint users is available, that does not necessarily mean it's going to be accessed by someone. It's going to depend on your so-called threat model, which is, you know, different for everybody. But if you're still concerned about that, you can maybe leave your phone at home or something like that. But again, ultimately, it's going to come down to a data protection legislation issue. Like we have in Europe with GDPR, that is where real actual change will impact that. Mm.
It's interesting. No one ever makes their New Year's resolution like cleaning up their threat model. Seems like
They should do. That'd be great.
Yeah, yeah, no kidding.
Really, that's my new New Year's resolution because I've already given up the ones that I
that you already started. Yeah, it's only 10 days into January, Megan. It's never too late.
Joseph Cox is a reporter for Motherboard. He focuses on hackers, crime, and technology. You can read all about his story, how he paid the bounty hunter, how quick he was able to find the phone, and so much more writing. And he can also be found at Joseph F. Cox on Twitter. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
We appreciate your work. Thank you for joining us. The Consumer Electronics Show is, believe it or not, about to wind down. Easy for me to say. I haven't been there for nearly a week like some people I know, reporting on all of that future thinking innovation from the sprawling show floor in Las Vegas. But one person that I know has treasured it all with her team, and she joins us now. Welcome back to the show, Lindsay Turrentine, Editor-in-Chief
at CNET. Hi, how are you?
Awesome. How are you doing, Lindsay?
You know, I came back to my room last night and passed out immediately of fatigue, and so slept for a million hours, and I have never felt better.
Well, you are glowing right now. It's great to have you on. I'm happy that you got so much sleep.
An impressive Wi-Fi in Las Vegas as
I know.
Well.
Yes, yeah. We're doing okay here.
It turns out Wi-Fi is another technology that's really looking up at CES this year. Let's talk a little bit about CES, because obviously your team at CNET has been covering it top to bottom. Maybe we'll start with Google a little bit here. We heard a ton of news coming from Google regarding its assistant technology, and that kind of ties into the smart home. Obviously, smart home is so much bigger than just assistant. This year's CES seems like a big smart home year. I feel like we've been saying that for the last couple of years. What are some of the cooler innovations that you saw announced this year? Is the smart home as big as CES wants you to believe it is?
Well, I think that what is going on this year is that smart home has been big at CES, like you said, for years. Yeah. And it's no different this year. I think that it's died down a little bit in the sense that the concept of smart home is not new. And this year feels like there's a lot of interesting innovation going on, but also a lot of assistant catch-up. Both Amazon and Google are working very hard at this show to teach everybody, to remind everybody that they're there and to teach people how to use it. So Google has three times the presence this year. Three times the presence. And let me tell you, Google was big at the show last year. And this year, what we're seeing is that every single device that gets announced, or most devices that get announced, have both Amazon and Google Assistant built in. It's no longer this kind of one or the other. Okay. Google is showing up in every single thing.
Mm-hmm. And not only that, Google brought a roller coaster, which, I mean, who else brings a roller coaster to CES?
I mean, yeah, Google brought a roller coaster. To be fair, it's a flat roller coaster.
Oh, next year. We can always look forward to next year.
It's more like what's the right word for it? Just a coaster?
Okay. All right. Or a roller. Yeah.
It's a coaster, and it's really here to teach you, you know, kind of about what they're telling us Assistant can do. But one of the coolest things that Assistant can do, and this is the one that really blew us out of the water, is the interpreter mode, which isn't totally available on all devices yet. It's really just in a couple of hotel lobbies here right now, but they say they'll be rolling it out soon. Interpreter mode on any device that has Google Assistant built in will step in and be a translator for you with, this is like 37 languages, maybe a lot of different languages. You can just say to turn it on with your voice and start, and it'll start interpreting between two people. We tested it out in German, we did some Mandarin, really worked pretty well. It's kind of amazing.
So 2018 was like a big tech lash, as they call it, you know, just big backlash against the big tech companies. Are you seeing any of that at CES, or is it still just as big and popular and as exciting? And are there still as many smart fridges that no one you know will ever have?
I mean, people who are at CES and companies who are at CES want to be here. Right. People are here because they want to be part of this conversation. They're excited about technology. They're excited about trying new things. One of the things that I think is actually, in an optimistic moment, really cool about CES is that it's now a place where both big companies and small companies are coming with their experiments to test the waters. So we saw stuff like Procter & Gamble this year using some kind of Kickstarters type platforms to try out some new things, and then bringing these interesting new devices from their labs to the show to see how they resonate. One of the devices that they brought is a makeup wand that has a camera built in. It's basically a face printer. And it doesn't print faces, it prints on faces. But you use it, you scan it across your skin, it senses blemishes and freckles, and actually just paints makeup onto the spots where it sees a difference in skin tone.
What?
I didn't try it, but a few people on my team did, and they were completely blown away.
And so it did it well.
stuff like that. Yeah.
And did it well. Wow.
That's amazing.
That is amazing.
I've been spending a lot of time with Jeffree Star and James Charles makeup YouTube tutorials, and I still haven't gotten it right. So that's what I need.
Well, Megan, you don't need a face printer. You're fine.
Thanks.
True.
I love the panels that you guys do. They're always fascinating, and I get to watch them in my pajamas and not worry about getting germs. Ashley Esquetha did an amazing panel on all the sex tech that was at CES. And then there was some controversy about the Innovation Award. Can you tell us about that?
I can tell you what I know and what I've read. I was crushed because I had to be somewhere else and didn't get to see the panel. But I know that I heard she did a fantastic job. The controversy is that a manufacturer that makes a vibrator for women was given an innovation award, which is the award that the CTA gives to vendors they think are making progress. They give this award before the show. It's actually not given at the show. It's something that sort of sets them up for the show. And then CTA called them up before the show and said, basically, never mind, we can't give you this award. You won't be an Innovation Award winner. The one thing I have not gotten a chance to do is ask CTA what's going on. So they haven't commented on it that I've seen. And I don't want to speak for them. And we can only tell you what that manufacturer says the CTA said. But that was that they called out a clause in their contract saying that if something was obscene or potentially offensive, they could not award this. And that's what was going on. The manufacturer got very up in arms, wrote a big public complaint about this and said that sex products, especially aimed at men, have long been available at the show, that there are things like booth babes at the show, and that it seemed offensive to not give this award to a product that was aimed at women. That's what has happened.
It's perfect subject material for Gadgets if that show ever comes back.
You're going to get 5 tweets right after this.
I know. You know, that's why I did that, Lindsay.
Why hasn't that show come back?
Well, it's a good question.
Free time.
Yeah, we might have to figure this out. We'll talk. We'll talk. Speaking of talking on phones, what about foldable phones? I know that the amazing Royal FlexPi was shown off at CES. I think people were not very impressed. But what do you think? First of all, did you get a chance to see that? And what do you think that might have to inform about this upcoming foldable phone that Samsung has around the corner?
I didn't get to see it myself. Obviously, you're showing the story. Our team got a chance to see it. There are always these devices at CES that are a proof of concept. And like you said, This wasn't necessarily the best proof of the concept. I think people's response is like, this is bulky, and why would I want this? Samsung, on the other hand, says it's coming up with a flexible screen at some point this year, that will be rolled out, and that they are really bullish on this technology kind of turning around what has become sort of a slow handset market for them. Mm-hmm. I think that FlexPi is taking advantage of their solo position at this show. And I think that it's likely that what comes from Samsung will be better.
Yeah.
The question is, can they make it thinner and more flexible and really more useful? If they really can turn it into something that is both convenient in a small sense and then can take the place of something like a tablet and be better for consumption, then maybe it'll do well.
So what about 5G? Do we know anything more than we knew before CES started about the future of 5G?
No, not really. We don't know a lot more. What we have gotten a chance to do at this show is talk in real terms about what 5G is going to do. When I go talk to people and just audience members, readers about 5G, generally people's responses to 5G are a little bit of confusion or a little bit of not necessarily skepticism, but just kind of like, okay, well, it's going to be faster, right? The industry is really eager to tell everybody that it's not just going to be faster, that it's going to change the way that our products work together and that we communicate and that we wire our homes or not wire our homes, as the case may be. I think the show there was some controversy and some frustration over the way various vendors are talking about 5G. Is 5G real? Is it not? The good thing that we got out of the show is a chance to talk about some real life scenarios about what 5G will change. So I was on a panel with somebody from Samsung who himself is in a band with his high school friends in Korea. And he was like, when we start to talk about 5G, I start to think about how my band could actually play together live because of the extraordinarily low latency. I'll be able to set the beat with a drum, and somebody on guitar in Seoul will be able to chime in, and we'll be able to play real time. It's almost impossible to imagine that now because there's such a lag. Mm-hmm. So I think that this show is a chance for people to talk about the differences between 5G and 4G in a way that people can start to wrap their brains about. But honestly, it's going to be at least a year probably until anybody starts to experience this in their real life.
Yeah, right. Transportation, obviously, every year, CES, transportation is a huge part of that, a part of the show. And there's some really cool stuff. Anything stand out for you there?
There was the Hyundai. They just brought a small model. It's like an eighth of the size of this of the car that they are talking about. It was a concept car for an emergency vehicle. It's a car that has legs. And so it's like it walks, and the idea was that in a first responder situation, this car could actually step over obstacles and go get people and then leave and then also retract its legs and roll out of the way. We also saw some real life stuff, like the Nissan announced their upcoming replacement for the Leaf that's going to go much farther and much faster and put it in a competitive spot, at least from a range and power perspective, with like the Tesla Model 3. We're eager to see that because it's much less expensive. So that was exciting.
Mm-hmm. Another thing that I can't quite wrap my head around, but hear about at CES often, and I don't know if it's going to happen anytime soon, is the over-the-air charging. What did you learn about that?
We learned that it is actually, in theory, coming. One of the over-the-air charging manufacturers said that this over-the-air charging will be available in a phone this year. We don't know what phone yet. But the idea is that the small devices will be able to charge over long distances using this technology. I think that it is going to be, while it may be show up in a phone and we don't know which phone in the coming year, seeing how hard it has been to mainstream wireless charging in general, I think it's going to be quite some time until a lot of devices have over-the-air charging at a distance. But the dream is real, and if this turns out the way that this manufacturer says it will, that's exciting. It's very exciting.
That's pretty cool. I like it. Robots, yet another theme we always hear from CES. And I feel like every year it's like robots, it's the future. And it never quite lives up to that whole Jetsons Rosie the Robot thing that I have in my mind anyways. What do you think? Were there any robots that stood out that you'll be getting for your home?
It depends on what you mean by robot.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
There's definitely some Rosie style robots here. Samsung had a whole bunch of them at their keynote, including one that I think is probably the most useful, maybe not the sexiest, the air purifying robot, which actually just roams around your house and finds a place where your air needs to be purified, purifies that room, and then keeps going on. Samsung also had a healthcare robot. That's the air purifying robot on your screen right now.
Okay.
There's also a home healthcare robot that is really meant for people, elderly people, probably living alone. It can take vital signs, remind people to take their medicine, send alerts if people fall down and can't get up. So some useful robots there. But the single-use robots, I think, are really where it's at. And we've seen that now for a decade with the Roombas of the world. The clothes-folding robot, which I'm sure most of us have heard about by now, it made a big buzz at the show this year. It's a single use product. It's basically just a large cabinet. You feed one item in at a time and it folds the clothes all to the same size. So single uses done well, that's where it's at with robots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the single use that does, I mean, my favorite robot is always my robot vacuum because it does the job that I want to do least, I guess. I mean, I don't mind helping my kids with their homework and all that stuff, you know, finding the weather some other way, going outside, for example. But yeah, vacuuming. But I have always wondered, like, it could do so much, like, why not? I mean, were there robots with Amazon voice services in it or Google Home? Like, I mean, robot vacuums that also. Why is the single use the thing that works?
I think it's because doing a single thing mechanically is very difficult. Mm. And it takes a lot of engineering to do that one thing right. You know, I've noticed that the robot manufacturers, the successful ones, right, the robot vacuum manufacturers, for example, do have Amazon, Alexa, and Google Home built in now so that you can voice trigger your robots. That's kind of a nice to have, again, on a single item deal. the robot that can do everything, I think we're just not there from an engineering standpoint yet. It's going to do everything poorly rather than one thing very well. And even in the example of the clothes folding robot, everybody's eyes light up because we all hate folding laundry. That's my least favorite job. I hate it. That's why I just have a big camera full of clean clothes all the time. And they're wrinkled. Let's get real. But that machine, though it costs $1,000, it's still, you have to stand there and feed the item to it one at a time, which takes a long time. And I'm not going to do that. It's probably best used in the back room of the Gap, honestly, to make sure that all the shirts are folded exactly the right way. And I'm guessing that the target market for a $1,000 clothes folder is small business, really, if we're realistic about it.
Also, if we get a robot to fold all our laundry, when will we listen to podcasts?
True.
In the car.
In the car.
Okay. In the car. But you're right.
Self-driving car, then we're looking at Instagram in the car. So
while we listen to podcasts. See, we're multitasking now.
We'll be looking at Instagram and watching podcasts.
That's true.
Yes, I forgot about that. You could watch right now. This one.
Yes, this one. Like right now.
Lindsay Turrentine, it's so great to see you again, Lindsay. I'm happy that you survived CES, and I hope that you don't come home and then get the con flu. I'm really crossing my fingers.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you. It's been really fun.
Lindsay, always great. CNET.com/CES if people want to find all of CNET's coverage. There's also a live stream from the show. How long does that go? When do you guys wrap up the live stage?
We don't wrap it up until partway through the day tomorrow.
All right. So you still have time.
The bitter end.
Well, have fun and best of luck. And we'll talk to you soon, Lindsay. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Jason.
All right. Talk to you later. Bye. Up next, imposter meat strikes again. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by FreshBooks. Now is the time to set new business goals, and FreshBooks is the ridiculously easy-to-use cloud accounting software that puts you, the small business owner, in control of your business. FreshBooks is full industry-standard accounting for users of all levels, so even if you're new to accounting, it's going to work for you. You can send professional-looking invoices in seconds. Makes it super easy to do that. And then you will see whether it's been sent, viewed, if it's been paid, or if you have an overdue invoice that you're waiting on. You can accept online payments directly from your invoice. That's going to get you paid an average of 2 times faster because there's no friction. They get the invoice, and it's like, okay, cool. I can pay directly from there. They don't have to like jump through hoops to make it happen. You can quickly generate and access accounting reports in the FreshBooks dashboard and share those reports with your accountant or financial advisor. They're going to love that. Create proposals with rich text content and images and request your client's e-signature as they accept proposals. Again, removing that friction. Send invoices, estimates, and proposals in multiple languages. FreshBooks automatically connects to your bank account to make things easier, and that updates your expenses daily automatically for you. But if you want, you can import expenses in bulk or upload a picture of a receipt as it happens and then let FreshBooks do the rest. Use the FreshBooks mobile app to keep tabs on your business no matter where you happen to be. If you're going on vacation, you can still check in. And the FreshBooks team is constantly adding new and improved features. They've added an accounting and reports tab in the navigation bar for easy access to the numbers that matter to you. They also have a double entry accounting functions that have 7 new features built in, including cost of goods sold, other income, general ledger, a whole bunch of features, accountant access, a balance sheet. Also, new advanced payments where you can mark time as unbilled, revenue streams, and more. And if there's anything that you do not understand, you can check out their award-winning support team. They have Learning Hub videos that you can tap into and learn more there. Stop using Word and Excel for billing. That's just going to complicate things. Make 2019 the year you upgrade to FreshBooks. Try FreshBooks free for 30 days at FreshBooks.com/TNW. Make sure and enter Tech News Weekly in the How Did You Hear About Us section so they know you came from this show. That's FreshBooks.com/TNW. And we thank FreshBooks for their support. And now let's spend some time talking about the impossible. That is the Impossible Burger. Impossible Foods launched the first iteration of the Impossible Burger in 2016. And yes, I'm kind of talking about a food product as if it were a tech release on purpose, because now the company has unveiled Impossible Burger 2.0 at the Consumer Electronics Show of all places. And many journalists got the chance to eat the meatless, but totally meat-tastic, I'm told, burger at the show this week. Russell Holley from iMore is one of those people. Welcome to the show, Russell. How you doing?
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Absolutely. It's great to get you back, man. So first of all, there are two ways to approach a review of the Impossible Burger, either as a vegetarian who can finally eat meat without guilt, or as a meat connoisseur who can possibly replace their meat eating habits with a low carbon footprint alternative. Where do you stand? What was your perspective on this going in?
So I'm definitely a carnivore, and I, you know, work from home, so I do a lot of home cooking, and part of that is actually kind of making my own burgers, kind of grinding my own stuff. So I come from that, from very much a what would be called a burger purist, I guess.
Yeah.
For that kind of thing.
And had you ever had version 1.0 of the Impossible Burger? Had you tasted that prior to this?
No, I had been told about it on several occasions, but there wasn't a restaurant near me that did it yet, so I hadn't stopped in and had one for myself.
I have not had one. Megan, you have, right?
I have had several. I am a pescatarian, so I haven't eaten red meat in about 12 years, and I went to the launch of the 1.0, and it was delicious. And I've eaten it at several restaurants.
There's a few around here.
Whenever I see it on the menu, I eat it. But, you know, when we went to the launch, I love calling it the burger launch, they said it wasn't really for me because, like, I'm also fine eating veggie burgers or not eating burgers. Like, I don't have this attachment to the burger that keeps me eating. And it is interesting because a lot of people have that attachment. Like, it reminds them of their youth, the taste, the, you know, the smell of grilling. So did that, I mean, do you have that kind of attachment, Russell?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I do a lot of, you know, grilling and smoking and stuff like that at home. So it's something that I enjoy spending a lot of time. It's really just the cooking process that I enjoy. And that was a big part of this 2.0 launch, was actually seeing these burgers prepared on an open grill over an open flame and watching as it, you know, browned up and charred exactly like a beef burger would. It was really kind of fascinating.
Fascinating and just kind of creepy too. It's just this is so weird to me, and I know I'll need to get over that because I really do need and want to try one to see it for myself. How exactly is this meatless burger achieved? I mean, it looks like meat. It even kind of bleeds like meat. I mean, there's so much here, and I imagine 2.0 is probably even closer to the real thing than 1.0. But what kind of ingredients are going into here to achieve this?
Yeah, so when we were talking to the people from Impossible Foods, they talked a lot about how this is a special blend of soy products and potato protein with a couple of different oil mixtures that come in to kind of give it that drippy, almost greasy feel that you would get from a burger. And the red part, the part that, you know, does that kind of bleeding thing, is actually a byproduct they call heme, which is short for hemoglobin. It's a soy-based hemoglobin that acts very much like blood would. Wow. With actual, you know, with actual hemoglobin in it. And it was true that, you know, he cooked a burger medium rare and he put it on a bun and he cut it in half. And then when he split it and squeezed both sides, it genuinely looked like the burger was bleeding as though it were a medium rare burger. I actually have one here if you want to see it.
Oh, you had mentioned that you might get one. And I was like, wow, it was a joke. But no, you have one. Okay, so let's take a look at it.
So we have, this is actually, I learned after the event that there's actually a White Castle down the street that has them.
No way.
And so this is actually the White Castle Impossible Burger. And it just looks like a beef burger.
With like some onions in there or something.
Yeah.
So when you go into White Castle and you get an Impossible Burger, are you paying more or less? You're not getting actual beef, but you're getting something that's very, very fashionable right now. So maybe it's cost more because of that.
No, so the price was actually the same for that versus the 100% beef. And, you know, size not being everything, the Impossible Burgers are actually slightly thicker than the 100% beef burgers that they make in their sliders. I actually watched them cook them side by side a couple minutes ago and did not notice until they had them on the same platter. Wow. But the regular Impossible Burgers are actually thinner than the Impossible Burger, the beef burgers are.
So the price is lower, but I mean, the environmental price is way lower, right? I mean, we just can't survive eating as much meat as we do as a planet, like environmentally. And then that, I don't think I'm not making that up, am I?
No, it was actually a huge part of the presentation was the CEO on stage talking about, you know, just kind of the environmental effect of having just as many cows as we do. You know, just existing in spaces just to be turned into meat is just a very expensive, both, you know, financially and environmentally, over the course of their lives. And that can just be completely eliminated with this as an alternative.
Wow. And just think that if this is what they can come up with to replace beef, like, you have to imagine that there is work being done to replace other, you know, types of food. It's just, it blows me away. So we've kind of danced a little bit around probably what many people would say is the most important aspect of this, which is how it tastes, how it compares, what your experience was. Like, what do you think? How does it compare? Would you go back? Well, obviously you did for the purposes of this show, but what did you think?
Yeah, so this is definitely something that if I see on a menu, I'm going to go ahead and order it. This tasted like any other kind of $10 burger that you would get at a decent, you know, kind of sit down place. It's better than you would get at kind of your standard fast food place. You know, the kind of smash burger technique that you would see at a lot of those places. But it definitely is right up there with, you know, kind of your standard $10 burger.
And the 2.0 is exciting because it's, you know, the 1.0 was only at the fanciest of restaurants, and it was probably like $18 to $25. It wasn't at White Castle. So is it going to be at other places equivalent to White Castle?
Yeah, so the idea is to have this available in a bunch of different places. As far as I know, this is actually the only White Castle that it's currently at, and I think it may just be for the show. I'm not totally sure on that. But the deal here is to just make it available in as many places as possible, and not just restaurants. Later this year, we will see the Impossible Meat be available in grocery stores. We'll actually be able to you know, form your own patties and make your own burgers or meatballs or things like that. As a part of this launch, they also had people walking around serving tacos and empanadas and meatballs and stuff, all made with this same Impossible Meat. And it all had the same, you know, incredible taste and texture where, you know, you could hand this to someone and no one would know that it wasn't actually beef.
That just blows me away. And that what you just mentioned is an important component of the 2.0 release, the release candidate of this burger meat, is that 1.0, it was just burger, right? Like, I don't know if it came preformed in the shape of a hamburger or how they did that. But this newer version of the Impossible Burger is actually pliable and usable in many different ways in the same way that actual ground beef would be, right?
That's right. Yeah, version 1.0 was actually sent frozen to restaurants where they could then prepare it as they wanted to, but it showed up in that kind of disc form. This we watched as they, you know, took, you know, just a bowl full of this material and formed it into patties and went through the entire cooking process. It was all just kind of done, you know, right on hand.
So what we haven't really got to the point, why was it at CES? Like, what is there any, like, does it have Alexa built in or Google services? Like, what was tech about this?
Yeah, so there's no headphone jack, there's no wireless charging, there's really no reason for this to have been at CES aside from, you know, there is kind of a technical fascination to how this has been created. You know, the actual process of, you know, putting these ingredients together is in and of itself a form of technology, and that was kind of the tongue-in-cheek way that the Impossible Foods people approached CES.
Wow. Okay, so I think at the end of the day, you having not eaten the first version, but then having eaten the second version, and from what I'm gathering from your write-up and this interview, this next question might be redundant. But my question going into this interview was, after you eat it, are you at a point where you were like, you know what, this could replace my red meat eating if it were available everywhere? And I kind of think it sounds like the answer is yes, right?
Yeah, I mean, if I sit down at a restaurant and I see this, this is definitely something that I would consider, you know, ordering at least most of the time. And the thing that really excited me was being able to use it at home. And that's going to depend a lot on kind of the price per pound compared to ground beef for me. If it's just prohibitively expensive, then I probably won't make that shift. But if it costs about the same, I have no problem buying this over ground beef for a vast majority of the things that I would cook at home.
Amazing. And I'm even more hungry now than I was at the beginning of the show. Thank you, Russell. And you have made it to almost to the end of CES. So congratulations. I hope that you make it home not feeling the con flu, as I wished Lindsay the same. That's always what happened to me. Russell Hawley, imore.com. Thank you, Russell. Really appreciate you coming on the show and telling us about the Impossible Burger.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, man. Have a safe travel.
Thank you. Bye.
Later.
Last week, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez took the oath of office to become the youngest congresswoman in history. And at the same time, a video surfaced of the congresswoman dancing on a rooftop That makes it sound much more scandalous than it really is, and less interesting than it is from an internet copyright perspective. Here to explain the history of this meta meme is staff writer for Wired, Louise Mitsakis, who covers security and social platforms. Welcome back to the show, Louise.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
So the video, which we will show, not because we will show in its fair use because we're talking about it. And it was uploaded in 2009. Tell us about the AOC video and the video that inspired it.
So it was uploaded in 2009 when she was still a student at Boston University. As kind of an aside, I think this is really fascinating because she's one of the first kind of prominent lawmakers to be young enough that we can actually kind of find this stuff. But so it was part of a wider meme, and she and her friends who uploaded this video were not the first to do this. This other woman actually uploaded a mashup of these kind of classic 80s movies. The Breakfast Club was kind of the most prominent one in the video, and it was mixed with this Phoenix song, which was a big hit at the time. And so people started copying the Breakfast Club video, and what they did was that they made their own videos copying the Molly Ringwald dancing style. So it was a mashup, basically, and it was, you know, an early version of a viral meme on YouTube. Only a couple years after YouTube had started did this video come out.
So the creator of the first video, she said the band that the song was from the video, Phoenix, loved it. They invited her to a show, but their record company, Liberation Music, not so much. Tell us what they did.
Yeah, so Phoenix is a New Zealand artist, and they were represented by this record label in Australia. And what happened is that in 2013, a Harvard law professor, Lawrence Lessig, who is actually a copyright reform legend, he uploaded a video at an event in Korea where he was actually showing these videos and talking about fair use. And then the record label sent a DMCA takedown notice and said, "You're violating our copyright," which is extremely ironic. And he filed a counter notice and said, "No, I'm not. You know, this is fair use. This is for educational purposes." Ironically, this is for educational purposes about fair use. And they ignored that, said, "We're going to sue you." So Lessig and the Electronic Frontier Foundation countersued, and they won the lawsuit and settled for an undisclosed sum, which was then donated to the EFF. But it's this really interesting battle because, you know, were they to have lost and were, you know, these other Listomania videos, you know, other manifestations of the meme, had they been targeted, you know, we would have, you know, possibly lost this video of a future congresswoman to history, you know, to overzealous copyright protection.
Yeah. And I mean, what's interesting to me is that now, you know, like you say, we're kind of in this modern era of people publishing so much of their lives on YouTube. We're moving into this world where this is going to be more prevalent. Like, this is kind of just the beginning, right? And over the next 10, 15, 20 years, this is going to, this is kind of the beginning of this new window into the, you know, people's lives, essentially, and taking something that once seemed so innocent and maybe shedding new light onto it through a different lens later as their lives progress. So it's fascinating to me there. Another kind of interesting thought I had on this copyright parallel, not just of the music, but of the dance moves. I'm sure you've heard that, you know, in recent months, Fortnite, the video game, has had its own challenges to whether the dance moves, or what they call emotes, in the game are copyrightable or copyrighted, that someone could claim and say, "Hey, don't put that dance move in that video because it's it, well, that was my dance move. That was my move." What about the Breakfast Club dance moves? I mean, is there any, I don't know, how does copyright apply with that and not just the music itself?
Yeah, I mean, the thing that's really interesting about copyright policy is that it seems really straightforward. Like, I created this thing, I own it, I don't really see what the issue is. But, you know, I think the Fortnite example, this example really shows that it's much more complicated than you might think. For example, there was another lawsuit that was settled late last month over a YouTube star who sued another YouTube star named Poppy, arguing that she stole her persona, you know, that she had, you know, owned the intellectual property to her persona and Poppy had stolen it. And that was also settled out of court and there was no money exchanged. But I do think it's really interesting, especially in the age of kind of taking memes and people extremely quickly reshaping a piece of culture, you know, millions of different times. I think that that's really difficult. And I do think that there are situations, to be fair, when a small artist gets ripped off by the biggest video game in the world, for example, you can argue, or by a, you know, an artist much bigger than them. And I do think that there are, you know, genuine issues for the copyright holders. But, you know, I don't really want to live in a world where college students can't dance on a roof and then upload a video to YouTube of them doing it. You know, it is a really hard line, I think, that we haven't really figured out in the age of the internet at all.
Yeah.
So in your piece, you write that current copyright policy more unfairly affects underrepresented groups. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think in some situations, for sure. The example I use in the piece is from the early 2000s when Biggie Smalls was sued because he had sampled a couple of songs in his in one of his albums. And now those samples actually don't appear if you buy the record today because the copyright holders, the record label of the samples, sued him. So I do think this can be a problem where you're having courts and record labels actually police the you know, intellectual and art being created by an underrepresented community. And I think that happens a lot. And you know, what also kind of happens is that copyright law gets wielded for other purposes. Like I've seen video game companies issue DMCA takedowns against streamers that they don't like for streaming their video game, for example, and just as a kind of form of protest against the streamer, not as, you know, really because they're upset about someone playing their game and promoting their game. But it is kind of this weird gray area that I don't think has been totally decided by the courts yet, especially in the age of YouTube and, you know, Tumblr and Instagram and Twitter.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned Lawrence Lessig. Like you said, he's always been a huge proponent of fair use, supported what he called back then, back in 2008, remix culture. Obviously, that was a while ago. That was more than 10 years ago at this point. Has remix culture survived and thrived over the past 10 years? What is the condition of fair use now as compared to then? Because a lot's happened to challenge our thoughts around fair use. YouTube is just one big example.
Yeah, I mean, so another kind of issue that people have been talking about recently is this court case last year where a judge ruled that it, you know, possibly was a copyright infringement to embed certain kinds of media and news articles. You know, embedding a video from a tweet in a news article to discuss it or something. Like, there is kind of this blurry line that we haven't really figured out. You know, the age of BuzzFeed, where people were just embedding tons of media and news articles, you know, that's kind of come into question about whether or not, is it okay if someone took a photo and then you embed that photo in your news article without, you know, paying for the copyright for that photo? I think there is still a lot of issues that are coming up that are, you know, have the potential to impact the way that the web works and how web pages and embedding and hyperlinking work. You know, we've seen proposals out of Europe where Spain wanted to charge for hyperlinking, or, you know, not being able to hyperlink without, you know, paying the person who you're aggregating a news story from or aggregating a blog from. I definitely think that you're also seeing a clash between judges and courts who don't necessarily understand how the internet functions, which makes all of this way more complicated than it probably needs to be.
How much of this is just a simple algorithm problem? Like, you know, YouTube just using this scattershot technique of going through, just taking things down, the three strikes you're out. You know, the original person who uploaded this had her original account was taken down because of this. And, you know, there was, it would just disappeared into the ether. It never would have come back up if this video wasn't found someplace, you know, if Lessig hadn't won his lawsuit. So how much of this is just YouTube randomly taking stuff down because of an algorithm?
So it is pretty automated through the content ID system, so that, you know, if you upload a song today that has, you know, it's copyrighted, you're probably not going to be able to keep it up there. And I think some of that is warranted, right? You know, artists deserve to get paid and you shouldn't just listen to music for free on YouTube with no ads. You know, you should be using something like Spotify or whatever if you want to really support those artists. So I think the content ID can be a good system. However, there are kind of all of these situations where stuff just gets taken down haphazardly and the content, the copyright holders are not necessarily even looking at the videos that they're taking down because it's just, it's happening in an automated way. So I definitely think that that is a problem. It's just so vast and random. You know, I could upload a video and it doesn't get caught by the algorithms for whatever reason, whereas you might upload something that is very clearly fair use, but it gets flagged. I think it's gotten slightly better over time. But it's definitely still a problem. And a lot of stuff like streaming video games, you know, talking about music, which, you know, some people would argue is fair use, I think is still kind of in this weird gray area where you can still be served a DMCA takedown notice and you might still have to fight that. And it's not necessarily as clear cut as it might seem to everyone.
I know in the early 2000s, there was, you know, that was a time when many, many people just download music illegally because there was no way really to do it. You know, you had to buy the $17 CD or you could, you know, use a service to download music. But then when iTunes came around, there was sort of, you know, there was now a legal way to do it more easily, pay 99 cents for a song. I'm noticing, like, if you go into like Instagram stories, you can add like popular music to your story. I assume that Instagram is then paying the artist for that. I mean, do you see that technology becoming more popular, like easier for us to just make videos with music and we're not maybe paying so much money, but somebody is paying the artists?
Yeah, I think you've seen a lot of these Spotify integrations where you can like actually add the song on something like TikTok or through Instagram, or, you know, people bring the music platform. It's kind of integrated into the social media platform, and that definitely helps. I think it also gives people a much easier way to find the song and to actually go support that artist if they liked that video that a creator made. But you still see a lot of copyright issues come up. And I think really there's the random algorithm problem. And then there's also the trying to silence speech through targeted DMCA takedown requests. So I think those are kind of two separate issues. If someone is a company targeting you because they didn't like what you said about their, you know, their IP, or is this just like an algorithm issue? So I think those are the two areas. And I think both of them are kind of helped by a Spotify integration or something where it's very clear how you got that music, you used it in a fair way that was, you know, sanctioned by the platform, sanctioned by the people who control that IP, which makes it easier, you know, if you want to say something bad about a Kanye West song or something and, you know, not get in trouble for it.
Mm-hmm. Louise Mitsakis is a staff writer at Wired. She covers security and social platforms, and you can read all about this fight and more about the meta meme. Her story is that viral video of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez dancing is a meta meme. It's up on wired.com. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Take care. We'll
talk to you soon.
It's time again for the
Are you ready?
Switch.
Yes.
This time, Jason Howell and I we're going to switch phones, not for 6 weeks, but for 6 years. And
there you go. Just kidding.
No, just kidding. Not 6 years. We're not even going to switch phones this year.
No. We're switching it up. We're switching up the Twitch.
Yeah,
switch.
We had a long discussion about this because phones, like the pick between the Pixel 2 and the Pixel 3 and the iPhone 10 and the iPhone XS, there's not that much difference.
I mean, there's some. Like, I know you'd probably appreciate the night mode, the new night mode for the camera in the Pixel 3. But, yeah, we've done that a couple of years. Mm-hmm. We're like, what haven't we done yet?
Yes. So we decided we're going to switch alleged laptop replacements. As you can see, I have not replaced my MacBook with my iPad fully.
I can see how you're not using the thing that I'm going to be using on
the
show.
Yeah, I know. You have it right there.
Yes.
I try to use it, but I always go back to my beautiful MacBook, and I don't really know why, but I'm going to try. So this is an iPad, the newest iPad, the 11-something. It's the smaller version of the new iPad and the fancy new Apple Pencil.
Do you use the Apple Pencil a lot?
I do, yeah. Okay. And it's engraved with Dream Girl on it.
Perfect.
So, that's
perfect. That's what I would engrave in my Apple Pencil.
And what do I get?
Okay, so I just want to check it out. I want to do a once over. Everything looks in good condition.
It has Face ID.
I just want to make sure if there's a scratch in it, I'm going to write it down so that when I return it. You don't blame me for that.
Yes.
So you're getting the Pixel Slate, which is what I have right here, which is what I've been using as my primary computer in all accounts. So I've been taking this home with me. So it's my primary computer at home. It's my primary computer here because my desktop that I normally use when I'm in the office has been really weird lately. So I've just been using this. I use this for everything computer lately. And so the Pixel Slate with the Pixel Slate keyboard attachment, you can fold it up just like your iPad there.
So I get a bigger screen. You did not order a pencil because you don't use pencils.
I don't really use that. But I think you're going to like it.
I know. So we're going to do this for how long did we say? I'll let you decide.
Let's do three weeks.
Three weeks
sounds good.
3 weeks.
That sounds long enough because you can't do one because that's just like tapping your toe in the water. I think 3 weeks is long enough to kind of settle into it.
And I can get Apple Music on this, right?
Well, no, you can.
You can get it. It has an Android app.
You can because of the Android app.
Yeah.
Okay, so what? Maybe. No. 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 You're doing it wrong. So this.
Oh my goodness. What?
Yeah, so you can tilt it any way you want. See?
And can I use my face to log in?
I don't know about using your face to log in, but there is a fingerprint sensor on the top.
What? Up there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you've got another laptop in front of you.
I know.
You don't know how to do this, do you, Megan?
Okay.
Yes. It'll take some time. Don't worry.
Our fingerprints are different. So.
Yes, they are. You're not going to get in with my account.
You want to set that up?
I guess we can kind of.
It's already. You're doing it wrong.
It's falling apart. This is a nightmare. Okay, so what do I do? Like that?
Yeah, that, just like that.
Oh, so I get get 2 points.
You only get one.
Versus unlimited.
Oh,
unlimited.
Oh.
I can already tell where this is headed,
but they do have something in common. They both charge with USB-C, so that's exciting.
Where does it go?
It magnets on the top and charges
there we
that
go.
Way.
Okay.
So I'll be using this for iOS today, which will be interesting.
And I'll be using this for All About Android, which will be interesting as well.
Because I think it'll be helpful because I know lots of Android users use iPads, and I know lots of iPhone users iPhone users might use it.
Well, I think what I'm curious about is that an iPad is definitely more of a mobile device than a computer, let's say, right? Mm-hmm. Like a productivity environment. You can use the iPad in a productivity environment with the attached keyboard, but the OS at its core is really meant to be a mobile device, right? Chrome OS is designed to be a productivity environment. They just happen to also be able to sandwich in there the Android app compatibility. So I'll be curious to hear your perspective on how productive you can be in that environment mm-hmm. versus my perspective coming from that to here and how productive I am here and how this kind of experience is tailored for that particular device.
Well,
that's what I'm really looking forward to.
I mean, you can use Google Sheets and Google Docs and I don't know. What else do you use for productivity? Hangouts probably has an iPad.
I don't have a trackpad here. That's a big deal for me.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
Really?
Yeah, I use that trackpad all the time. Are you kidding me? I want a trackpad on my laptop.
Oh, yeah, you don't have a trackpad.
So
That's
if you
true.
Could give me a trackpad, that would be great.
Okay, sorry. I'll talk to Tim next time we chat.
Good. So, yes, 3 weeks from now, I'm sure we'll check in on it.
Yeah, we'll check in.
Each week and see how things are going. Mm-hmm. Or you'll notice that things aren't going well because pencils are falling everywhere.
Be careful when you put that in your purse because it easily comes off.
Be careful when I put Dream Girl in my purse.
Exactly.
Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday starting at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern at twit.tv/live. You can be a part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv or even sit in the studio. We've got some guests here that emailed tickets at twit.tv to watch us live and make us feel important. So thank you guys for coming in and doing
that. Yes, thank you. And subscribe to our show. You can do that at twit.tv/tnw or just go to any place you get podcasts. Search for Tech News Weekly. You'll find us. And don't forget to follow us on all the social medias. That's where Tech News Weekly is on Twitter. Twit is on Twitter.
Yeah.
Behind the Scenes Twit is on Twitter and on Instagram. You can see yesterday there was a picture posted of Leo with 3 boxes of meat. So go to Instagram and see that. I promise you it's there.
Was it real meat or was it fake meat?
No, it was real, not impossible meat. So
okay.
You have to check that out. Yes. And if you want to tweet at me, I am at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. Thanks to everyone who helps us do the show each and every week. John, Burke, Josh, Colleen, everyone who helps us out each and every week. We really appreciate it. And thanks to you for watching every week, because without you, we would not be here. We'll see you next week on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.